We considered the
authority of the Amendment Revolution to the Gulf.
March 1856. Today we want to take a look at how the theory of the Amendment Revolution worked out in Cuba and to determine to what degree it was verified there. To approach this problem, I begin first of all by utilizing the main points that Trotsky utilized in explaining the theory of the permanent revolution. First of all, to determine in what way Cuba's development could be said to be highly uneven. To do this, just give you a brief indication of the background of Cuba. Cuba, along with Hispaniola, was the first area in the Western Hemisphere to be colonized. I'm sure you all know where Hispaniola is.
Anyone tell me?
It's the island that today is divided between Haiti and the Dominican Republic. That is where the first colony was set up by the Spaniards, and Cuba shortly thereafter, but Cuba rapidly became the main base of the Spanish colonization efforts, and as a matter of fact, it was a center for the whole Caribbean area. In those days, Caribbean was a Spanish lake, nothing to do with the United States because the United States was not even yet colonized. Havana was an old city before the Pilgrims landed in Massachusetts, or the other British subjects landed in Virginia. It was an old area. When the Spaniards came into Cuba, they found a race of people there called the Caribbees, whom Columbus writes of as being extremely good-looking people, both the males and the females, and a people that he'd never seen, the likes of which he'd never seen before, extremely loyal, extremely gentle, extremely unwarlike, and very trusting. As you can see, they were perfect suckers for the Spaniards, who came in there with their ideas of getting gold and of disseminating their syphilis. So the Indians in the island of Cuba were virtually exterminated by the Spaniards, either through disease or through forced labor. Spaniards put them to work digging gold in areas where they thought they could find some gold. The Caribbees had some gold trinkets which the Spaniards took and melted down and sent back to Spain. And then they began to work them on areas of land there, which the Spaniards set up in a form of ranches. And it wasn't long until none of these people were left. And Spain, coming into Cuba, and in fact wherever Spain went in those times, imposed its own feudal relations on the country. Feudal relations meaning serfdom for the inhabitants and slavery. Because of a lack of labor power, the Spaniards were willing to utilize any form of servitude in order to pin these willing hands or unwilling hands to the task at hand, which was to dig gold and silver and to grow such crops as was necessary to supply the miners with a minimum amount of food. So wherever Spain went, they established their own relations which reflected the ones they had in Spain. And the Spanish idea was for each Spaniard who came from the upper classes generally in Spain, that is the feudal aristocracy, to enrich themselves and then return to Spain. That was their idea of how to colonize the New World. Now over the centuries, the Spanish policy in relation to the colonies was the same as other European countries, which was to prevent the development of industry in the colonial areas and to utilize them as sources of gold and silver and of raw materials. This was a very carefully worked out policy. They even prevented trade between the various colonies, and they barred trade between the colonies and other European powers. So that the pattern was to take raw materials from areas like Cuba. Cuba introduced sugar very early. And I think Columbus brought the first sugar plants there, so far as it's known. They take these raw materials back to a key port in Spain, either Seville or Cadiz, and there they would impose a high tax on the goods that were brought in. The tax would go to the crown. And these raw materials, say, for example, like cotton, would be sent up to Belgium or to Holland. There would be worked into cotton goods, whatever they wore in those days, blouses, shirts, and skirts, and stuff like that. Then the finished goods would be brought back to Spain, into these same ports, reloaded on the ships, and carried back to the colonies. So that you might have the strange business of cotton being growing in New Granada, which is now Colombia and Venezuela, cotton being growing there, shipped over to Cuba, and from Cuba over to Spain, and then up to Belgium or to Holland or somewhere in Germany, worked up into a finished handkerchief, brought back to Spain, back over across the ocean to Cuba or to New Granada, or carried by manpower or burro power across the isthmus of Panama, reloaded on ships, carried down the west coast of Spain, down to Santiago de Chile, and maybe overland back over to Buenos Aires, the same handkerchief. So the costs naturally kept pyramiding on there. And they deliberately barred the colonies as much as they could from developing their native industries. Well, actually, this led to a great deal of dissatisfaction, as I'm sure you remember was the cause in the colonies in the United States, if you're up on your American history, and it was a big impulse to develop native industries. Well, these, along with other grievances, led the colonies to break loose from Spain, and the revolutionary period of their independence struggle lasted from about 1810 to around 1824, about a 14-year period. But Cuba was not among those colonies that were able to break loose. As the struggles developed on the mainland and in Mexico and in the Central America, those who were most bitterly opposed to the freedom struggle, the refugees, the immigrants like that, they all landed in Cuba, so that Cuba became a sort of Miami of its time. All counter-revolutionary went to Cuba, strengthened the counter-revolutionary forces there. And in addition, Spain kept armies in Cuba which were much larger than all the armies they had in all the rest of South America, because Cuba was the prize colony in the estimation of Spain, as long known as the Pearl in the Antilles, or as Columbus said when he first discovered it, the fairest land that man ever set eyes on. So they hung on to Cuba as grimly as they could. And then there were a number of reasons in addition to that that kept Cuba from breaking loose, finding its freedom. The reasons were that there was a struggle for power between the United States and Great Britain and France. And in this jockeying around, all of them reached the decision that none of the others could have Cuba. Their policy was to bar the others from taking Cuba, and thereby to keep Cuba in Spain's hands, because none of them would agree to Cuba's own freedom, which would, because of her own policies. So all these things worked together. So over the centuries, three great problems began to arise in Cuba. The first of them was the necessity for an agrarian reform. Some of the estates in Cuba amounted to as high as 33,000 to 40,000 acres, even larger than that, up into hundreds of thousands, I think you'll find certain ones of them. These were vast estates which were only partially cultivated and largely reduced to one or two crops like sugar or tobacco. Sugar by far being much larger than tobacco. The value of the sugar crop maybe 95% and the tobacco crop about 5%. It gives you the relation between the main crop and the secondary crop. And the next problem was its national independence, because the Cubans actually had the same desire for independence, the same need for independence that the other Spanish colonies had, but their struggles were long delayed because of these many different circumstances, so that this problem grew in urgency and became more and more acute as the years went by. And finally, the third great problem was the necessity to industrialize Cuba. It was simply an area which produced raw materials for the industrially advanced countries. For many years, particularly Spain, which sent the materials into other areas because Spain itself was in a peculiar position of not developing its own industries. So in this country, too, like the other Spanish colonies, there was a tremendous need for industrialization. These are the three problems in Cuba that kept growing in urgency over the years. Now, the Cuban independence struggle began in 1868 under Maceo and some other leaders. In 1868, was fought for about 10 years, and there were huge forces involved in this, relatively speaking. Peasant armies, guerrilla forces, began fighting in the eastern part of the island in Oriente, and then moved towards the west, and they put up a very strong struggle during that 10-year period. There was a revolution in the 60s in Spain which facilitated this struggle, but when the revolution came to an end in Spain, the Spanish crown made big concessions to the Cuban struggle, at least verbal concessions and some real concessions, and so the struggle for independence died down about 1878 and was not resumed until around 1895. In 1895, it began under the leadership of Jose Martí, and for 3 years, the struggle mounted in intensity, as it had in the previous period, until by 1898, they were very near victory, and it would seem that Cuba was being the last colony to break out of freedom from Spain, would have a very interesting career in the coming period. But that precise moment, the United States took over Cuba. Now, the date's quite important, 1898, because this is generally taken by serious students of the question as marking the beginning of capitalist imperialism in its financial stage, monopoly stage. It's the point that Lenin marks as the emergence of modern imperialism. And that was the Spanish-American War, which brought the United States into world prominence as a leading contender for world power. And the turning point was when it conquered, took over Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines, because they went down there under the guise of helping the Cuban freedom fighters, but they ended up with the Philippines and Puerto Rico, as well as Cuba, and they put an occupation army in Cuba. Now, when the United States took over Cuba, what happened was that it accentuated the uneven development of Cuba. Instead of filling in the parts where they were backward or where they were underdeveloped, the United States accentuated those uneven sides of its development. Big investments, particularly in the sugar industry, an enormous impulsion to the development of the sugar industry, and the beginnings of large investments in mining, which is another raw material industry. In other words, the mines in Cuba, which are very rich, especially in copper and nickel, produced ore in a form which was shipped out of Cuba and then refined in the United States. So it wasn't even refined in Cuba. So that this uneven characteristics of its economic development were accentuated by the United States. And in the years from 1898 to 1902, that was a four-year period when they had an occupation army, up until 1959, January 1959, the condition of the peasants and the poor people in Cuba became worse than they were before. Some improvements were made in general by the U.S. in stamping out yellow fever and like that, but the living conditions and the way the people lived was actually worse than they were before. So that it was a common observation in Cuba to note that the peasant in Cuba was worse off in modern times than he was when Columbus discovered Cuba. He lived in exactly the same kind of house, a bohemian made out of bark and the fronds from a certain kind of palm tree down there called a royal palm. It makes a miserable hut, even though it is a royal tree. They lived in these miserable things with bare earth floor and quite open to insects and to the weather, especially the rain. And their food like that was on a very low level. So they were worse off after four centuries then before the Spaniards brought Western civilization to Cuba. Same time, Cuba became a tremendous field for investment. At one stage, the investments of the U.S. and Cuba were as large as they were in all the rest of Latin America, if not larger. I don't have the exact figures at hand, but you can verify this very easily. But even when the takeovers occurred in Cuba, the size of the American investments was very large in proportion to what they were in the rest of the world. They measure something like the ones in Canada, completely dominate Cuba, especially around the development of the sugar industry. So the whole development of Cuba was very, very uneven under the Spaniards, and it became accentuated under American control. So this gave us some very interesting combinations. Cuba has the biggest sugar mills in the world. And you may not realize how big a sugar mill can be, but they are tremendous things. It's situated outside of the cities in the countryside on the plantations. The plantation, sugar plantations surround the sugar mill. And it's covered for miles and miles and miles. Nothing goes there but sugar, which is hauled into the sugar mill, the Central, when the crop is ripe. These vast plantations were the most efficient in the world. The soil was ideal for sugar growing, and the skills that were developed over many years were applied to the production of both the growing of sugar and its grinding. So they had the biggest and most efficient sugar industry in the entire world on this small island. And yet, those who worked this, the agricultural proletariat, were among the worst off in the world. They not only lived in these miserable huts, which I mentioned before, the bohíos, but the bohíos were situated wherever the worker might find a place for it. They had two divisions. One was a company town around the Central, living in barracks, the most miserable places, like some of the company towns you find in the mining districts in the western United States. And then those who had families would build their bohío just along the side of the road, because it was the only place to build it. Just along the shoulder of the road, they'd find, just build a hut right there. Or another place they would build them would be in the fire lanes, and they're called in Cuba guaraguayas. These are areas that are driven out through the sugar cane fields in order to make a fire break. It's like a fire lane. You have these in the west in the forests. Around Los Angeles, you know what a fire lane is. Well, that's where they would build their homes. And if they grew anything to eat, it would be right around this small little place. This is the way they lived, right around the most enormous sugar mills in the entire world. On top of that, they were only employed for 3 months a year, which was a great convenience for the sugar mill owners. They only had to pay them while they were working 3 months in the year, and then because of the very nice climate, they could scrounge for themselves the other 9 months. If they were fortunate, they got 4 months work. So that in the relative polarization of the class struggle in Cuba, there was an extreme opposites. On the one side, enormous wealth, largely centered in Wall Street. On the other side, the most miserable conditions among the workers. Extreme polarization of wealth and of poverty in Cuba. Quite in accordance with Marx, although I'm not sure that the Wall Street investors had read Marx and deliberately were trying to care more what he said about the impoverishment of the working class. Now, the normal pattern in Cuba was that investments were made were to extend these plantations on a vast scale. And the extensions were done sometimes in the most illegal way, through corrupt government officials who would give away great extent of land, thousands and thousands of acres, for maybe just being paid off. They'd be pieced off one way or another, or they would pay an nominal sum like 5 or 10 cents an acre for this beautiful land. And where the peasants did happen to hold some land, they were driven right off the land, and let them argue in court as to who actually owned that land and whether or not they could establish that their ownership went back to the time of Columbus. So that you had this other strange development, the extension of great big plantations and the driving of the peasants off the land in modern times, exactly as if it were back in the days of the primitive accumulation of capital. So we had this combination in Cuba, a big sea of backwardness, of misery, of disease, of hunger. And 90-95% of the poor people in Cuba had some kind of a tropical disease that could have been cured or prevented with a minimum amount of attention to health. And this great big sea of illiteracy, one-third of the people unable to read or write, disease-ridden, hungry, without work, unemployed. Right in the midst of this sea, you have one of the most glittering playgrounds of rich tourists in the entire world. Havana was a playground of the rich American tourists, and it was quite a spectacular place. You could put Las Vegas in one corner of Havana, and Las Vegas is really a piker compared to what they had in Havana in the way of odd forms of pleasure. I won't go into those. real seamen might be able to tell some of them we've heard about Havana. So you have the American standard of living, which is very high, flaunted right in the faces of the people in Havana. Rich Church himself coming there and demonstrating how things are done in America and how the Cubans should live if they had better sense than they had. That was the condition in Cuba. Now, the same way in politics, you had a strange combination that 90 miles from America, with all its boasted freedoms, you know that we're the freest country in the world, and we have the greatest democracy the earth has ever known. All right, only 90 miles from that, you had some of the most dictatorial and repressive regimes that the world has ever seen. Two of them were especially notorious. The Machado regime, which began about 1924 and lasted until 1923, and the Batista regime. What?
33,
yeah. And the Batista regime, which in two phases was especially brutal, the last phase lasting from 1952 to 1959. Right off the shore, 90 miles from home, one of the most dictatorial regimes the world has known. So, in general, what happened was that all these strange combinations were intensified by the United States. The problem of the agrarian reform, the need for a rounded development of their industries, and the need for national independence. These became more and more acute with the passage of time. Now, from this, we can easily draw the conclusion, looking back at the theory of the permanent revolution, that what Cuba needed was a good bourgeois revolution, good, like ours of 1776, or like the one in France, converted France from a feudal paradise into a model capitalist country at the end of the 18th century. The big problem was to end landlordism, which in its essence is a hangover from the feudalistic system of economy. Landlordism, which the principal landlords were American landholders and Spanish landholders and some Cubans. To win their national freedom was another big necessity. National freedom being necessary for them to develop their own industries and thereby open the way for industrialization. Another need, political democracy. That is to break these dictatorial regimes which actually functioned as puppet regimes for Wall Street. And along with this, tied in with all these needs, the necessity to raise the cultural level of the people. First of all, to spread the literacy, to teach people how just such a simple thing as to be able to read and write, then to develop their skills in the various trades and occupations, and to open up the possibilities for Cuba to really utilize its natural resources. It has some very good natural resources so that it can take its place in the modern world. So what Cuba needed was a good bourgeois revolution. All right, the question comes up then. Again, we're looking at the theory of the permanent revolution. Why couldn't the Cuban bourgeoisie lead this revolution? There were some Cuban capitalists, you know, some Cuban bourgeois figures. Some of them were in the rum industry, for example. Some of the best rum that you may have ever tasted was made by the skilled hands of the Cuban bourgeoisie. And the Cuban bourgeoisie is divided up into three sectors. One of them is predominantly American. I mean, their home address is in the United States. For example, in the cattle industry, some of the biggest ranches there were held by Americans. One of the prominent ones was the King Brothers Ranch. They have a whole county in Texas where they have the biggest ranch in the United States with special breeds of cattle, most modern cattle, very resistant to tropical climates. It's supposed to be very good eating. I never ate one. Supposed to be very good. And they had opened up some tremendous ranches in Cuba with their special breed of cattle. I just indicate this as one instance. Mining industry likewise, predominantly American. The next important sector of the Cuban bourgeoisie were the Spaniards. They were born in Spain and they were really Spanish citizens and really tied in with Spain more than they were with Cuba. It was Spanish capital, owned by Spanish stockholders. They were interlocked with the Americans. Finally, there were the Cuban bourgeoisie, who in this scale were the very
of the various layers. The Cuban bourgeoisie was especially subservient, real lick spittles. And what they actually did was to play the role of native agents of Wall Street. There was nothing independent about them whatsoever. Their whole outlook was geared into that of Wall Street. And it was common knowledge that the most important political figure in Cuba was not the dictator, but the ambassador from the United States who talked things over with the dictator, and the dictator carried out things according to the will of the American ambassador. So the Cuban bourgeoisie was an exceptionally subservient bourgeoisie. Now, what about the petty bourgeois in class in Cuba, especially around Havana? Well, they were exceptionally weak. I'm talking now about the figures like Trio Soteras, and he's a typical one. A petty bourgeois Democrat. He believes in democracy insofar as it works and insofar as he can apply it. But the limits for that are very narrow in Cuba, and he knows which way he knows what's possible and what isn't possible. There were a number of others, and each of them had a party of one kind or another. There was the Auténticos, for example, with one large party in Cuba, which was democratic in character. But these Democrats in Cuba were tied in very closely with the militarists, and Cuba had a large military establishment. It was built and constructed under American auspices, with American military aid, with American money, with American know-how, with American military missions from the very beginning of the century. And this whole military machine was constructed with the supervision of the U.S. And all the Democrats in Cuba, without exception, were tied in with this military machine to one degree or another. And in all big questions, they bowed to this military machine and went along with what it wanted, so that the final control and the final arbiter in Cuban politics were the military forces, that is, this professional army, which the leading exponent turned out to be Batista. And it was on the sufferance of this military force that the Cuban Democrats operated. So they were not in a very good position to lead a revolution in Cuba, although sometimes they talked very militantly about the need for a solution to some of these questions that were ever on everybody's minds. Now, what about the Cuban peasants? Is it possible for them to lead a revolution? Well, we know from what we learned yesterday in regard to the theory of the permanent revolution that it was not a very likely possibility, because as in other countries, the Cuban peasantry was scattered over the countryside, isolated from each other. Communications were very, very poor in Cuba. In some areas, no roads whatsoever existed, only narrow trails, and even though it was scarcely passable at certain times of the year. And they were divorced and separated from the main cultural and political stream. In addition, there were divisions among those from the poorest of all who were semi-proletarian or almost proletarian, who worked on the sugar mills, to those who had isolated farms in the mountains or isolated patches of land in the mountains, to those who had larger areas of land, say like 160 to 400 or 500 acres, and who hired workers in the season to help them on their farms. So for these various reasons, it seemed to be excluded that the Cuban peasantry could constitute itself as a homogeneous political force and lead a revolution of the kind that Cuba needed. So now, what about the Cuban proletariat, the Cuban workers? Was it possible for them to lead this revolution, this bourgeois revolution? Well, the Cuban workers are quite interesting from this viewpoint. They began to become radicalized in the 1920s under the impulse of the October Revolution. As we recall, that in the theory of the permanent revolution, it was believed and projected that when the October Revolution would occur, they didn't know the dates yet, but when it would occur, it would give enormous impulse to socialist revolution in Western Europe and throughout the world. Well, this turned out to be true, and one of the places that it turned out to be true was in Cuba. The October Revolution had a big impact on the workers in Cuba. And in the early 20s, a communist party was organized in Cuba. I don't know the exact date of that, but it was probably around 1922-24, in that period, or maybe 1923, began to be organized. And it grew in strength in Cuba. So that by the time of the fall of Machado, and he was known as the Butcher of Cuba, that was before Batista's time, he was a ferocious dictator. But by the time he fell, there was a brilliant opportunity for the Cuban workers to lead the kind of revolution that Cuba needed. As a matter of fact, the thing that brought Machado down in 1933 was a general strike. As a general strike that was swept clear across Cuba from one end to the other of all the workers. And that was the thing that finally convinced Machado's friends that it was time for him to take a plane and get out of Cuba, which he did, and the contingents of the revolutionaries came down to the field just in time to see him take off, and they fired their guns at him, but unfortunately they didn't hit him. He may have had a few bullet holes in the plane when he landed in Florida. From 1933 to 1935, it still seemed that in Cuba there was every chance for a successful revolution, because there were repeated strike waves in Cuba, in the sugar industry and in other industries. There were strike waves that occurred almost spontaneously, one strike after another, in that two-year period. This was before Batista had consolidated his power, when he was still weak, and it was uncertain as to what would be his exact course when he did consolidate that power. As a matter of fact, these strikes were so militant and went so far that in many places in Cuba, the plants were seized by the workers, taken over by the workers. This was before the sit-down strikes in the United States. Plants were taken.